just the work that you do. That's why I invited you both here. You both play a major role in educating folks and providing food resources. This gentleman gave me some seeds, which my mother is now growing in the backyard.
That is exciting. So we are actually on air. I didn't realize how late it was, but we are past the 11 o'clock hour, and we are on air. And if you heard this little bit of conversation, today we're going to be talking about food, a right, a privilege, a commodity. And I have these incredible people in the studio with me, and I'm going to ask you all to introduce yourself and explain how you fit into this topic and into the community. So I don't know who would like to start. Do we?
Greetings, everyone. Can you hear me?
Can we hear you?
Yes.
We will, as soon as I talk.
Greetings, okay. I am Ofu Maja Egunjobi. I work with the Harambe House. I am the Food Sovereignty and Community Farm Coordinator. And I've been with Harambe House since 2023. I've been interested in growing food almost all my life. In 2011, when I lived in Atlanta, I was in a program called Habesha. And in that program, they taught the community different community garden skills and different skills. That was the first time I was a part of a organization is with growing food, and that kind of got me into community gardens. But I'm born and raised in Savannah. My family is from out of Pula and Bloomingdale, and they've been growing things and having farms since then. That kind of was my initial interest. But this is just something I really like doing. And in the midst of doing this, I realized maybe about 20 years ago the importance of food sovereignty. That word, food sovereignty, being in control of the food that you grow for the nutritional purposes, and just for the, you have to eat, and when you control that, and when you are in control of those things, that's very empowering, and especially considering just some of the different institutions that are in charge of or in control of some of the food that we eat right now. Sometimes it's more bottom line driven than nutrition driven and
yes,
medicinal driven.
Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction. I don't know who'd like to go first. Next.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleasure to be here. I'm the Reverend Michael Chaney. I'm the priest in charge at the Episcopal Church of the Epiphany here in Savannah, and where we operate a food pantry. I'm just coming from there now, every Tuesday morning from 8:30 to 11.
Well, we will make sure that we mention that. 8:30
awesome.
To 11.
We can talk plenty about that.
And where is the church located?
We're at the Episcopal Center. That's the former St. Michael and All Angels Church at the corner of Washington and Waters at Daffin Park.
Oh, okay. Okay, so you're right at Daffin. That's a wonderful location.
I also work with the Community of St. Joseph, which is an outreach program to our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness.
Okay.
So that's obviously food insecurity is an issue
right.
when you're living outside
right.
as well.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. And our co-host.
This is Apollo Johnson. Happy to be here in the space with these two esteemed individuals who work on a subject that is just very, very important to me, given all of the upheaval and inconsistency of governance that we're experiencing. Food is a right, it's a privilege, and it's more than just a commodity.
Yes, thank you. So before we start, I just have a really special announcement. This is our 100th show. And I know numbers sometimes take on greater significance than they really deserve, but I think for me this is a real milestone. And I just want to mention that Albert Strickland and I started the show in 2017. We responded to a call from the UU Church to come to Ron Hall and chat. And we both got really excited about the opportunity. I wanted to do 30 minutes. I couldn't imagine filling an hour. He won that discussion, and we started with 1 hour. We called it Voices of Resistance. And we went to Mexico. Sadly, he died in Mexico. And I came back and ran into Louis Clossy, who said, hey, let's bring it back. And I thank him for believing in me and teaching me how to engineer this board, because I was not quite an expert in electronic things. I thank WRUU for surviving the Financial Times and allowing the show to come back on air. I truly appreciate Apollo, because he has seen the value of this show and has offered to work with me in a very special way to bring it back to life. Because right now, my ability, I'm old, and I don't do social media the way I should. And I don't have any more, my granddaughter's gone. She's off living with her mother now. I'm living with her father. And she was my social media expert. So I'm struggling by, but thanks to Apollo, we're going to get the show off the ground. We're going to build our listenership, and we are going to, you know, our message, which is so valuable, is going to get out to so many more people.
Well, this is community radio, and we're yes. going to focus on connecting and building our community. So
yes, and I that's right, and I want to thank our co-hosts and guests, our listeners, who I know could be off on a midday and Tuesday doing many other things. And those who are listening now, I want to thank you all. And I want to take a deep breath and say, here's to another 100 shows.
Awesome.
Yes. So thank you. So you're right. Today we're talking about food insecurity in the U.S., which seems to me in a way like an oxymoron. In such an incredibly rich, plentiful country, we know that there are so many people who are food insecure. They live in food deserts. They have minimal income. They are seeing cuts in federal food programs over the years. They are forced many times, because of their income and the deserts they live in, to eat foods with ingredients with sugar and other cancer-causing agents. And we know that many of the food they eat has GMOs in it and other kinds of issues which are not supporting their health and well-being. So let's get the conversation started. Where would you like to start with this conversation?
Well, brother, would you tell us more about what you're doing in the community and how folks can help or participate and build on the work of Harambe House?
Okay, well, we currently have a couple of community gardens and community farms going on. We have a community garden in Hudson Hill. We have a community garden in Woodsville. We have a community farm in Garden City, and we also have a community farm in Pooler. With the community farms, what they are, they're on private land, and it's about, we're planting about an acre on each plot. And with one of the farms, it's an actual farmer, and he gives us a lot of assistance from building fences to he has the tractor and different tools. And on the other farm, Miss Gigi. She has a plot that her grandfather used to grow things on it, and she sometimes grow things and sometimes not, and she wanted to get that back going again. And so the whole idea of the program is it's around Savannah, Pooler, Bloomingdale, Garden City. They have people that's like, may have a small farm, anything less than 10 acres.
Right.
And they, you know, some of them are not active. Some of them may just have animals or whatnot. But we want to support those farms, the smaller farms, so that they can support the community gardens. And so we use those farms for training. We use those farms for any larger projects. And we also use those farms for the different processes and the different ways you operate on a farm is a little different from a community garden or right. a garden in general. Because the garden in general, when you think of garden, it's more like a hobby thing. On a farm is, you know, they're selling it, they're growing things to sell. And then secondly, it's a lot of different processes. If your tools are not close by, you may end up, that may cause you an extra 2 hours of work.
Right.
If you know, so it's different positionings, having things, and then you have a whole different set of tools. You have more than just the standard rake and hoe when you're on a farm. You have to have some type of heavy equipment. You have to have something to move that. And so learning right. those things and introducing the young people who we work with to those different processes. And the planning is a little different, too, because you're growing a lot. And then you can grow, anybody who's growing food, a half or quarter acre is a lot. You can grow a lot on those little plots.
That's right.
So so being able to work with an acre, a half an acre, and then can transfer some of those skills and things that you and skills and processes to a smaller community garden and those smaller plots. You can work on your efficiency and time, and then you can really put a lot into growing the best food, the most nutritionally dense food.
Right.
So that is the gist of the program, from community gardens to community farms. But we also work with within Savannah. It's from my understanding, there's like 80. Community farms. They're on registries, like 80 different community farms. And I'm also a part of the Savannah-Chatham Food Policy Council. And from being on that council and working with the different people on that council, it's a, for about the past really 20 years, but really 10 years in Savannah, it's been a real strong urban gardening, urban farming, food sovereignty movement that's been going on. And in Savannah, within the past 10 years, it's getting really strong. So it's a community that's just kind of formed itself.
Okay, so you're saying 80 community farms.
Yep, community gardens.
Community gardens, that's what I... Okay, 80 community gardens in Savannah.
Yes.
And they cooperate with or served by many of them with these community farms that are in the more slightly outer areas.
Well, that's the intention. That's what we want. Yes,
that's
what we want to start doing.
And do you bring young people out to the farms to learn farming?
It is a group of young people that from the Harambe House that I work with, about a steady 4 or 5 that's like the core.
Yes.
But from that, whenever we're out, especially if we're out in Hudson Hill, because of the positioning, it's right across from the park. So whenever they see us out there working and the young people know each other, they'll just come over and, hey, I ask them all sometimes, especially if I have a project that needs a lot of people, they'll just be walking by and I say, hey, y'all want? And they always are more than willing. Yeah, because, you know, they know each other and they're talking and laughing and joking. And so we're out there working and we do want to, going forward, we do want to do more things with the young people. We want to, especially going into 2026, we want to do a lot of workshops, teaching. That's going to be a lot of our focus in 2026, because 2025, this year we've been working on like the infrastructure part, just getting the different gardens together, this was the first time we've done anything with the farm. And and so getting that together. So coming in, especially going into January, going into the springtime, we'll have things in position where we can do more field trips and do more hands-on, and then they can get a chance to see things from seed to harvest.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That is the intention, and we're going to be working with the other community gardens and the people within the community movement.
That sounds great. So, Father Cheney, Michael, how would you like to be addressed?
That works for me.
Okay.
Whatever works for you works for me.
Okay, that sounds good. So tell me about your role in this whole Feeding Savannah effort.
Wow. That goes back. Let me give you a little bit of my history.
Okay.
I'm excited to hear about Harambe House and the work that you're doing with community gardens, because there is a connection between food, community, and spirituality.
Yes.
Food is storytelling. And as a child, I was fascinated with the role that food plays in our society, in our culture, and the storytelling that is involved with food as well. As a child, I worked with my parents with our church food pantry and doing Meals on Wheels. I grew up in Mississippi, where I was very conscious of inequity and injustice in our food systems.
Right.
And I took some of that with me when, as a 20-year-old, I went to college in Southern California. And my mother had asked me to go to church while I was out there, so I was going to tick that box off. And the first week, I was approached by some church members who wanted me to come make oatmeal at a homeless shelter that they were opening that week. And I wasn't going to turn them down.
No.
So here I am the first week in California making oatmeal at a homeless shelter. And I did that every Wednesday during my college days.
That was amazing that you came and that was right there, an opportunity.
That was wonderful.
Yeah.
And about a year in, I thought, I would really love to make red beans and rice, because that's part of my own culture.
Yeah.
It's where I come from. And I remember making red beans and rice at Union Station in downtown Pasadena, California. And the excitement that read on people's faces.
Yeah.
Folks who had come from the South or visited the South and had a connection to that food. You know, in the Christian Gospels, we say, you know, man does not live on bread alone. There's a storytelling to that bread that we distribute. I've taken that with me, been involved through my own spiritual journey in the idea of feeding people and sharing community resources.
Mm-hmm.
Is integral to our sense of community, our sense of belonging. So today, my church operates one of the local food pantries in our community. And we today had a wonderful breakthrough. We had entered into an agreement with some farmers from the Forsyth Farmers Market, and we distributed fresh produce this morning.
Ooh.
Along with our non-perishables.
Wow.
And that makes a difference. There's a sense of, I think, dignity and pride and a sense of belonging when you have something that's fresh and healthy.
Yes.
And that's supplementing the kind of canned foods that folks are relying on from food pantries. So that's what we're doing.
That's great.
We are operating a food pantry to help our neighbors who are food insecure at this time, which is a figure that continues to rise.
Right.
We're also reaching out to our neighbors experiencing homelessness, particularly around holiday times. We distribute care packages and blessing bags to make sure they're not going hungry.
That's great. That is really good to hear. I was part of a community garden on 39th Street for a while, and when I come down this way, I always look over. I usually take Abercorn straight down, and I look over, and it's flourishing, and it makes my heart feel good. Yeah, it's an important thing. And our goal at the time, which sadly we never realized, but we tried, was to involve the neighborhood at the time, which is very different than it's starting to look today, and to do some education, to actually do some cooking at the garden and talking to people who eat a lot out of cans and may never have seen a fresh ear of corn or a fresh tomato or things like that. And it was really special.
I was selling the eggplant this morning. Not really selling it, but I was like pushing the eggplant.
And was it people who didn't know what an eggplant looked like?
Well,
or no, pretty much
just didn't know how to cook it. Tomatoes are an easy,
easy.
Tomatoes and lettuce and squash, that stuff's fantastic.
Right.
But I actually made eggplant last night. I made a ratatouille, so I thought I could kind of sound like I knew what I was talking about.
That is great. Years ago, and it was probably back in 2017, we were approached, and I'm not even sure how the connection got made, by a woman at the library down at the location of the Savannah Mall, asked if we could do a weekly program for about 6 or 8 weeks about gardening, and that she was convinced that so many kids, they only know food when it comes out of a can. And if you actually showed them an eggplant or okra, they might not even recognize what it was. And it was a fascinating process of doing it, of bringing things in, of talking to kids. Kids are so enthusiastic, and they're just, I love kids. Yeah, so that's a really kind of special part of that. So your food distribution on Tuesday, remind me where it is?
We're at the new Episcopal Center.
Okay.
This is where my church meets to worship on Wednesdays and Sundays.
Okay.
It's the former St. Michael's building at the corner of Washington and Waters at Daffin Park.
That's right.
So our food pantry is open on every Tuesday from 8:30 to 11.
Okay. And do you find, is it fairly easy for people to get to you? I mean, people without automobiles, is there?
It is. It's not a far trek from Victory Avenue,
okay,
as well as Durin.
There
are a number of food pantries around Savannah. Feeding America is the parent company of Second Harvest, which has done immeasurable work in this community. And if you go to the Feeding America website, you can search by your zip code for food pantries near you, and you'll discover that there are a few dozen food pantries in the Savannah area.
That's great. I will make note of that. And I do notes after the show that I put up on the WRU website, and I will make sure to put that link in there so that people will be able to find a local pantry. And is the main distribution center, is that off Chatham Parkway where there's food distribution? I thought I passed something at one point driving down that way, and it looked like a Second Harvest center, but I'm not quite sure. But we will get the information
there.
So that
is Second Harvest, and it is located at, well, you have two. So you have one at 2501 East President.
Okay.
Right? And then you have another one off of Chatham Parkway.
All right. So that is what I'm seeing when I go by.
Mm-hmm.
So there is food, and to connect the food to the people is absolutely essential. So one of the things that I know we will talk about, I've mentioned, is the whole issue of food deserts and what a food desert is. And basically it's a place where people live, and particularly if they don't have automobiles or access to an automobile, and they may not have great access to our public transit system, the only options they have are these little corner stores. And these corner stores don't exactly sell a lot of fresh foods and vegetables. They sell a lot of packaged things. They sell a lot of, dare I say, junk food. And this, sadly, is where a lot of people wind up getting their food.
Well, I think that's what Harambe House, the whole issue of community gardens, or the reason for community gardens, is to disrupt that. And if I'm right, could you share more? And if I'm wrong, please correct me.
You're absolutely right. That the whole food desert issue, it's one that's it's you know, it's especially here in this part of the South, in this part of the country, where you can grow food year round. And 40 to talk about food deserts, but I do see it as an opportunity. I see it as an opportunity for, one, for food sovereignty, for the community to take control of the food that they grow. And also I see it as an educational opportunity, because the sad reality is that lots of times the junk food is chosen over fresh food because of, you know, just because of a lot of things. But and so we get an opportunity to, one, to start growing your food, two, start eating it, and three, to understand what's the nutritional value of the food. Why, you know, what does a tomato offer to you? What type of vitamins and mineral does a tomato offer? does a cucumber offer. We learn about eggplants because eggplants is a hard sell.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, they grow so easy and it's so pretty, but once it's grown, you're kind of like, okay, what am I going to do with it now? You know?
Right.
But you know, again, you get an opportunity to those, because there are people who are like master chefs and really know how to make the greens and all those things taste good. And so we have an opportunity to for that type of partner, those type of partnerships to form, and the whole idea of food being medicine, you know, and you get an opportunity to take advantage of that again, because a food desert, even in places where it's not a food desert, lots of times, you know, young people don't like vegetables. That's right. You know, not to put a stereotype on them, but in general, people don't eat the vegetables that they're supposed to have. And it's also something behind that, the fresh quote unquote fruits and vegetables, if they're not grown, if they're grown a certain way, if they're real pesticide heavy, if they're real, all of the value is going to be, all the nutritional value is going to be sucked out of it.
That's right.
As soon as you walk in a grocery store, you're supposed to be overwhelmed with the smell of the fresh produce. Anyone who's traveled to the Caribbean and all those places, when you walk up on you'll smell a tomato 100 feet away.
Yes.
You know, a real fresh tomato. And that goes, that's with all the fruit. So that's a reflection of the fresh fruits and vegetables, I say in quotes, may not be they have other things in them. I'm sure we're going to talk about organic and regenerative and all these different terms that they have, but it's basically saying that the food is not as nutritionally dense and valuable like it used to be. So I see the food deserts in general. That's why it's been a movement the past 20, 30 years, is because of the food deserts.
Right.
So, that's the silver lining in all of this, is that, you know, people are saying things like food is our medicine. You know, a couple of 20 years ago, people kind of thought that was like way out, food, medicine. What do you mean by that? Oh, but now that's, you know, general, everybody, because people are starting to understand the importance of eating right. They're starting to understand how it can assist and help with these different diseases. They're starting to understand that, you know, it's an alternative to taking a lot of medication. And they just, you know, and they have tasted a fresh something that they grown compared to something that was in the grocery store. And when they see the difference, they're like, oh, I'm hooked to this. I want to grow some more of this.
You're right, because even going into the grocery store, I mean, I can't remember the last time I bought strawberries in the grocery store and you actually could smell them. Or, I mean, I do remember buying cantaloupes and other kinds of melons, and you would pick them up and you could smell an end and know if they were fresh. And when's the last time we've smelled anything that smelled good?
That's fascinating. I was trying to show my son the other day how to tell if a melon was ripe, and we were sniffing them, and I'm like, wait a minute, I can't smell anything. The work that Harambee House is doing is vital, and
yes.
It really pleases my heart to hear about this work. Food is medicine. There's something about growing your own food as well that reminds us of where food comes from. You know, as you mentioned, food doesn't come wrapped in plastic. I mean, that's not how it was created. It has an origin, whether it's a vegetable or a meat or a cheese, it comes from someplace.
Right.
Those are important reminders that food is of the same kind of creative substance of which we're interconnected with.
Right. So yes. We're going to stop here for just one quick moment. I'm going to tell you, you're listening to WRUU, Community Radio with Global Soul, 107.5 FM in Savannah, and WRUU.org in the rest of the world. And we are community radio, which means we have no corporate bosses. The flip side of that, of course, is that we have no corporate money. And Savannah, this is your radio station. And if you value community radio and you value the lack of corporate control, we need your support. We need your help. You can go to the website, wruu.org, find the donation button. You can do a one-time donation or a recurring donation. And I have found that when I do a recurring donation, it's a very small amount of money. I don't notice it, thankfully, even though, I mean, I'm on Social Security and a very small pension. There's not a lot of money, but if I can do $5 or $10 a month, I can manage that. And when I see on my phone that the donation has been taken out of my bank, I smile. And I urge you to do the same, because this is a very valuable resource in our community. And while I've got your attention, I will tell you, we like to do public service announcements for things that are happening in Savannah. And Living on the Edge opening reception is for Teiki Zudema solo exhibition, Living on the Edge, Friday, September 5th, from 5 to 9 p.m. in Art Southeast, 2301 Bull Street, in the Starland area, in conjunction with First Fridays in Starland. Living on the Edge explores coastal locations where the forest turns abruptly into marsh, creek, beach, or sea. More information can be found at artsoutheast.org. And while you're listening to that PSA, if you would like, I could get more information about how one gets a PSA on the air, and if it is a contribution or not, I will definitely let you know. So thank you for listening to this little bit about WRUU, and thank you for listening. So we were in the middle of talking about the alternative to food deserts, and that being things like community gardens and farms that we can get people to in order to learn and understand where our food really comes from. So let's go back to that. Apollo, are you about to speak?
I wanted to add that we live in Georgia, and most of us think of Georgia as a big agricultural state, but we're actually 37th in the nation when it comes to production of food, and we produce about 30.28% of the food we consume in this state. So about a third of the food that we consume in this state is produced in this state. And here locally, we can produce about 12% of the food that we consume. So when I'm looking at these numbers, it just kind of shocked me, because I'd always thought that we were a more agricultural and rural state, but apparently a lot of the produce that Georgia produces, mainly peanuts, is exported.
Okay.
Right? So we have fruits and peanuts, and again, the food that we're producing, we are shipping and outsourcing other spaces.
Okay. But even eating 30% of what we grow here is pretty remarkable, I would think. But, yeah, I did learn when I came to Georgia from the north. I learned so much. And I was lucky to have hooked up with a native Savannian and who educated me in so many different things and reminded me that Georgia is the largest state east of the Mississippi. And is, when you drive the state, when you travel the state, you see how much agricultural land there actually is, and it's incredibly beautiful. I find going from the low country to the rolling hills is just incredible, and then getting to the mountains is amazing.
Yeah, I recently drove through West Georgia with my family, and it was I'd love to see the school buses that have been had the tops removed to transport watermelons. When you see a school bus full of watermelons, there's something
there's something
delightful
really
about that.
Yes.
You know? I think about them trucking watermelons to kids or schools or something.
Right.
But or to my house.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the issue of watermelons, because where I live, just south and west of Savannah in Hinesville, which is the home to the Army, I see the land becoming less agricultural and more suburbanized. And it saddens me in ways that it's hard to even talk about.
It's becoming industrialized as well.
And industrialized,
I go back
yes.
home and I drive through the Mississippi Delta, and I don't see vegetables or even cotton anymore or soybeans. Yeah. I see corn, lots of corn.
Lots of corn.
And corn, obviously, is used for high fructose corn syrup. It's used for energy purposes. But corn is rapidly replacing a lot of traditional crops to bring nutritional and cultural value to regions.
That's true. And I'm going to start looking around and trying to figure out. I know there's a lot of watermelons that are grown out my way. But I did become very close friends for a while when I first came here, and I wasn't quite sure what to do with myself. I started quilting, but then it didn't take. So, but I did meet an incredible quilter in Lutawisi, and we talked about watermelons and growing watermelons. And these are mostly small farms. They're very small farms, and they're. Purchaser of their watermelons is primarily Walmart, and they buy with those watermelons for 25 cents a piece and then sell them for at least $4.99. And I said, oh, that's awful. You do all the work. And they said, yeah, but where are the farmers? I have not found one farmer's market in Well, a woman who sells out of her house, and there was an incredible blueberry farm that I have discovered. But for the most part, there are no big farmers markets. And she said to me, we're small farmers here. We work 24/7, 7 days a week. We're at our farm. We don't have the time to take off to a farmers market. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what we need here are some co-ops. We need for farmers to join together, to share the burden. Maybe one person every 2 months goes to the farmer's market and picks up the produce from the farms in the co-op, and you work together. And I thought, if I were only younger, I would help set up a co-op.
Well, I think that goes straight to Apollo's title. Is food a right, a privilege, a commodity?
Right.
It's all of the above. There's also an injustice in our country when it comes to food and nutrition. We are hungry. I did some research yesterday. 100% of counties in the United States is experiencing some kind of hunger. 47 million people, that's about 14% of the U.S. population, is facing food insecurity daily. And that means we're hungry today. That's a daily challenge with hunger. And that has a health impact. It has a social impact. And it's even larger. I mean, there are over 50 million people who have turned to food banks and pantries to help.
Yes.
On an annual basis. One in five children, that's over 13 million children, do not have enough food to grow up strong. So hunger is real. Hunger is an issue. It might not affect you, the listener. It might not affect someone that you know or that you're aware that you know, but it's there.
It's there.
And as you mentioned, some of the causes of hunger, for example, where we live matters. We talked about living in certain areas. Yep. If you don't have transit, there's not a safe place to go get food.
Right.
If good schools if you don't have access to those, I mean, that can make it harder for some families to get the food that they need.
Right.
I looked at the rate of income. The lowest income quintile in the United States spends about a third of their monthly budget on food. Uh-huh. And if you can compare that to the highest income quintile, that's around 8% of their income.
That's
goes
amazing.
To food.
Middle
class folks spend about 13.5%.
Right.
I mean, but to think about spending a third of your income on food, and then what is the quality of that food?
Mm-hmm.
There are
right.
health challenges there. There are high cost of living that contribute. These are barriers
right.
to a future as well.
Absolutely.
And we have a justice issue when it comes to food in this country.
Yes, we absolutely do. And we have a justice issue with a lot of things, but absolutely with food. And I don't know if this is the right time to bring this up or not, but what we're seeing today with our food supply is nothing to what we're going to see, I fear, in the future. Because so many of the people who grow our food, who harvest our food are being taken out of the farms, taken out of the country, and it's just hard to know where this is going to be taking us in the future.
Well, this big new federal bill is going to have a drastic effect on hunger in America. I mean, it's cutting billions of dollars from SNAP benefits, from public school meals. It's going to mean hunger for low-income Americans. Tariffs are affecting grocery costs, but wages aren't going up.
Right.
This is going to be a tremendous impact on how people are going to be fed and sustain their families.
Well, I would like to put in or add in right there that the big, beautiful bill will cut approximately $186 billion from SNAP funding through 2034. It cuts the program and significant cost shifts to the states, which will leave millions of low-income Americans without some or all of the food assistance that they need to put food on the table. So, for example, $6.40 per person per day will be cut down to $5 per person per day, which is much more difficult. More than 40 million people will find themselves facing some sort of challenge to afford groceries, and it will affect 90% of the households. 90% of the households in this country will ultimately be affected. We have a number of challenges to the food system. So, like you said, Barbara, we have folks being deported, right? And so this causes further economic pressures in market conditions. So farmland to suburbia, right? So when you are going home and you're seeing land being that was traditionally farmland now being
clear cut and turned into suburbia.
Yes. That in itself, we have a housing issue, but what we're also doing is it seems like we're cutting off our nose to spite our face, right? So then we have the labor shortages. We have climate change, which I had an interesting conversation early this morning with some representatives from Georgia Power, which we're working on a program to remit the power for seniors here locally, and we'll get into that on another program. But the climate change is affecting the amount of food that we're producing.
Right.
And then the harvesting and processing, because without folks in the fields to process and harvest the food is left to rot on the vine.
Yeah.
So if a family... I'm glad you coupled that with the housing crisis that we're facing, because when a family has to present 40 to 50% of their income towards housing and another third towards food, what is that left with?
What's
to
left?
To pay bills? To pay for clothing? To pay for transportation? And this is not a new problem. There's a narrative around this that folks who receive SNAP benefits are somehow, you know, sitting on their duff and not contributing.
Right.
I would encourage your listeners to go check out a short film from 2016 called A Hug from Paul Ryan. In 2014, the House Budget Committee's War on Poverty sought to eliminate SNAP funding. And this is a five-minute film. It was produced through the Sundance Institute as part of their Take Five short five-minute films about justice. It follows a working mother, this woman, Tiana Gaines Turner. She works two jobs. Her husband works two jobs. They have three kids. And they rely on SNAP benefits to feed their children.
Right. That's
four jobs in a two-adult household. Mm. She was the only person who was invited to testify at the House hearing committee. She showed up. She testified, told her story, but she insisted that Paul Ryan, who's the Speaker of the House at the time, hug her so that he knew that she was a human being.
Oh,
it's a beautiful short film that shows that this is not an abstract.
No.
When we talk about hunger in our country, we're talking about flesh and blood, human beings who are suffering.
That's
we're talking
right.
about working Americans, children who deserve a better future than this.
Right.
It's a brilliant film that looks at the impact of cutting federal SNAP benefits.
Yeah. And as you're talking about that, and I'm thinking about this family, four jobs between the two adults, when do they have time to parent?
Yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah. I mean, that's just horrendous. And, I mean, I can tell my story. It's not as significant as so many of the stories we can hear. But I raised my two boys as a single mother I had a decent job. I worked for government. I worked for nonprofits. I chose not to work for corporations. I came out of the Vietnam era, out of the 60s, and I was not going to go to work for a company that made napalm or Agent Orange. So that was basically what I did. So when my boys got to a certain age, and they ate us at a house and home, and, yeah.
Oh, I know about that.
I could not retire until both of my kids were out of the house and I paid off my credit card debt. So I was one of the lucky people. I worked just enough. I made just enough to be credit worthy. Before I could retire, I had more than $30,000 in credit card debt to retire. And I was thankful I was credit worthy because it kept food on the plate. It kept the car running. I mean, you don't buy new cars in that circumstance. You buy old cars and they break down. But $30,000 worth of debt.
And that's thank you for sharing that story. In the last year, I've heard similar stories from people who I know who are putting their groceries on credit cards.
Yeah. Groceries and car repair bills. Mm. That was the credit cards, not luxury items. I mean, I raised my kids to never buy new unless you absolutely had to. We had a great consignment store down the street. We were on the edge of the rich neighborhood, so we were where the people gave their clothes when they were ready to move on one way or the other. And we were very fortunate in that. And my kids, even today, we rarely buy new unless we have to. But that's the reality of life. And this is a middle-class person whose children never went hungry. But at what cost? And what about the people that don't have that kind of credit? It's a horrendous situation.
I mean, I was a starving student, but it took a little creativity and a little ingenuity to make sure that bag of rice last for more than a week. You know, I and it was just me looking after myself.
Yeah.
When you've got an entire family involved, it gets more challenging.
It's definitely challenging,
and that's the challenge in the next level of community gardens and community farms. The challenge, we challenge systems. There's a lot of systems that need to be challenged and changed a whole lot. But to stick with the food system, the whole food system is the reason we're in this situation that we're in right now. And the challenge for the people who are aware of this and were motivated to start a community garden, start a community farm, get involved with this, is that we have to take it to the next level of cooperatives. Take it to the next level of, we have to think in terms of how much food, how much space do we need to grow food for our communities. And that community could be 10 people, 100 people, 1,000 people. And that's the, and we can do it. And well, first of all, community gardens, community farms, they're not going to solve the problem of the larger problem of these different systems and stuff that's going on. But at the same time, it can help. It can help with the problem, and it can get the ball rolling on the larger things that we may need to do as communities, as we come together to start to challenge Big Ag, because we're going to have to challenge Big Agriculture.
Yes.
Because that the industrialization of food is the reason when you need that, there's 1,000 acres. That's you know, a lot of farms have now. That's ridiculous.
Yes.
One person to be in charge have 1,000 acres. 100 acres is almost too much for one person.
Yes.
But what happens is those farmers who have that much acreage, that first of all, they're going to have to use pesticides and some kind.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to exploit the land and the people to work it in some way, shape, or form. And for the farmers who they end up getting exploited because they have to borrow so much money because they got to buy all these big equipment. So you'll have 1,000-acre farm, and they'll say he grossed $1 million, but he might end up with 100. He may be in debt. You can take that same 1,000 acres and give 100 farmers 10 acres, and they can be just as profitable without any debt.
That's right.
As that one that is exploiting people, because he's going to have to.
And he's probably twice the productivity.
Yes.
And just to segue into what you're saying. When you said, Barbara, that the farmers are growing watermelons for 25 cents and then right. they're being sold for $4.99, well, that's the definition of exploitation right
yeah. Exactly.
It sure is.
Exactly.
The big agriculture monopoly is nothing new. I think back to 25 years ago, Eric Schlosser wrote his book, Fast Food Nation. It was published in 2001, mm-hmm. and it does a great takedown of everything that you're talking about in terms of the monopoly of big agriculture, the breakdown of how much it costs to operate a farm, what your losses are, the minimized profits. There's also the 2006 book, Omnivore's Dilemma by Michael Pollan,
yes.
that breaks down the way that we get meals, whether we're buying it from McDonald's or from a major grocery store or harvesting it ourselves. It's a fascinating study, both of these books, in how we resource our food, how it comes to us, and also who profits from it. Profit is an underlying factor here about how we get fed and the injustice in that process.
Yeah.
And these books are 20 and 25 years old.
Mm.
This is nothing new.
This is nothing new. But so many of us see in so many facets of our life that this whole profit thing has just done nothing but grow. The commodification of housing, of food, of
healthcare.
Thank you. I was losing it.
Incarceration. The list goes on.
And the list goes on. And I also believe, because probably my coming out of the 60s, it leads to militarization. Because when you have people who can't make a living, make enough to feed themselves, feed their families, and certainly purchase healthcare, well, where's the natural place to go? Come join the military. You know, a steady paycheck. Health care for you and your family. And, I've heard people lately just talk about the poverty army. We went from a draft to a poverty army.
Well, this is the thing, right? When you have corporate-induced scarcity, right, what you do is you turn everything into zero sum.
Yes.
So in order for you to win, I have to lose. And when you indoctrinate and condition so many of our neighbors into this thought process, well, it's a natural progression for us to become such adversarial or have such adversarial politics, because people are telling us in order for me to win, you must lose. And we're pitting neighbor against neighbor. And this is why. And they benefit from the acrimony.
Right.
Corporate induced scarcity. That's a bar.
You just said something that stuck with me, Apollo.
I know. I wrote it down.
There's something of. You mentioned it before, there's a community connection here with food. I mean, for thousands of years, human beings have come together to eat.
Yes.
And why is that important? Why do we have a tradition in eating together? And this is of particular interest, and I don't want to hijack the conversation.
No, take it.
But there is something that is universally human about wanting to share sustenance with one another.
Yes.
I teach, I'm a college professor, and I talk to my students when they're organizing a group, eat together. It stimulates something in our lizard brain that says, this person is feeding me. They don't want me to die. I can trust them. There's something about sitting down and sustaining our lives together. This is why we go out and eat on dates or why we eat as families. This is the importance of that kind of communal aspect. Yep. In the Christian tradition, we have the Eucharist, which is a meal.
Right.
There is a shared food as a behavior. Probably goes back before the origin of our species, even. I mean, we have seen chimpanzees and bonobos, two of our closest primate relatives, that also share food in their social groups. The earliest shared meal probably happened around a campfire. Maybe we learned how to cook, and we had to sit there a little bit longer to make sure that food was heated and prepared. And
we had to break bread.
Right. We had to connect together.
Right.
But whatever,
right.
We do know, and there's data to back this up, that eating meals together is linked to higher well-being. When I was 20 years old and started at that soup kitchen, one of the things we did was we sat down and ate with people.
Yes.
And that brought us together. That brought us eye to eye. It wasn't like, here I am giving you a handout. It's we are eating
right.
together. We are building right. community. And when we look down on the people that we assist,
yes.
that does something I think, negative in terms of what that that relationship is about.
Right.
This is about sustaining one another. And as a person of faith, my scripture is rife with elements of commands for hospitality.
Yes.
And for feeding one another and holding each other up.
And to be the Good Samaritan, yes. And to be with people on an equal basis, sitting down together and sharing, not just giving, not just saying I'm being charitable
sharing.
To you.
Well, when you think that here in Georgia, almost 1.4 million people are at risk of losing some or all of their SNAP benefits, you have to kind of really stop and think, right? So it's about 10 million people, a little bit over here in Georgia. So one out of every 10 people, right? And then another 400,000 children are in danger of losing food security.
Yeah, that's a sad but true reality in this country. And it makes me, of course, look at the bigger picture. Are we a country or are we 50 separate semi-autonomous entities? And at the federal level, when you want to stop taking responsibility things, you punt to those semi-autonomous entities. And it's just sort of an easy political game to play.
Well, the disassociation is that we are the United States, right?
Theoretically.
E pluribus unum, out of many, one, right? And it seems that more and more the people who find themselves in governance, because elections are becoming so corrupted, but who find themselves governing, forget what they're supposed to be shepherding.
Right.
Right?
Right. It's true. I mean, I remember years ago saying, let states print, make license plates, put your cute little logos on them, and, you know, but other than that, that's enough. That's enough. I was never a big states' rights person. But when I look at what's going on at the federal level, I start thinking, well, you know, maybe we need to be more than semi-autonomous. Maybe we need to... I don't know.
Well,
I don't know.
Let's face it. States' rights is code that goes back to Reconstruction.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's another radio show.
Yes. Well, and it's interesting that you said that, because we have talked on this show and we've talked about the commodification of other rights. There is absolutely nothing in the Constitution of the United States of America that grants the kinds of rights we're talking about: food, health care, housing. Nothing at all. When we're faced with a criminal justice system, we do have certain rights, which sadly we see being eroded. But nothing about the right to live, nothing about the right to survive and nurture, be nurtured and be nourished. Nothing at all.
Well, I think it's ironic that the United States Department of Agriculture, the USDA, has identified four levels of food insecurity here in America, right? And one of the levels that they point out is that people skip or go whole days without eating, or they skip
yes.
meals. They skip some meals and they constantly worry about affordability and access. Or they're unable to acquire or provide healthy meals and worry about affordability of or access. And the access to healthy meals, people worry about affording groceries or running out of food. So at this day and age, with such surplus and such abundance that we have been forced to think this way, right? They are kind of coding the lizard
yes.
brain.
And I am going to ask you to hold that thought. We have 40 seconds to noon, which means something on this show because we do take a break for Robert Pollocky and Finding Happiness. But this is an incredible conversation, and I can't imagine anybody tuning out and not turning back, because we got a lot more to say here. And I thank our guests, and I'm going to pronounce your name wrong, I fear. Ofra?
Ofumaija,
Michael Cheney, and co-host Apollo Johnson. And we will be going to Robert Pollocky right now.
And now, Dr. Robert Pollocky on Finding Happiness.
Hi, friends and friends of friends. My name is Dr. Robert Pollocky, and I'm here to share a few thoughts on the topic of finding happiness. We are all acquainted with the Serenity Prayer. We know that the prayer encourages us to change the things in our lives that we can, a critical step in managing our happiness and well-being. While that first step may be difficult in many circumstances, the second portion of the Serenity Prayer can be daunting. I'm referring, of course, to the suggestion that we accept what we cannot change. There are many benefits to accepting those things that we cannot change. In our lifetime, every one of us has a parent, child, or friendship that has driven us to distraction or worse. Perhaps it's someone's personal bad habits, bigotry, or opinionated manner. Whatever the source, we all know that certain behaviors can drive us crazy, if we allow it. It is that last phrase, if we allow it, that is key. When we no longer allow it to affect us, but to a large degree accept that it is outside our control, we have moved to a higher level of maturity. Acceptance takes considerable effort and mental discipline, perhaps nowhere more so than accepting our own perceived deficiencies. Much of our life involves an inordinate amount of attention to what we perceive as our inadequacies. We may think of ourselves as too ignorant, too short, too tall, too ugly, or fill in the blank with your personal favorite. Imagine how much energy we would save and how much happier we would be if we added a modicum of acceptance. Even better, imagine if we not only accepted the deficiencies, but also looked to our strengths to compensate for our weaknesses. Take Edward O. Wilson, professor at Harvard University, winner of 2 Pulitzer Prizes and world-renowned naturalist. He writes this of himself: "I am blind in one eye and cannot hear high-frequency sounds. Therefore, I am an entomologist. I cannot memorize lines, have trouble visualizing words spelled out to me letter by letter, and I'm often unable to get digits in the right order while reading and copying numbers. So I've contrived ways of expressing ideas that others can recite with quotations and formulas. I write smoothly, in part, I believe, because my memory is less encumbered by the phrasing and nuances of others. I push these strengths and skirt the weaknesses." How many of us would have become victims or avoiders filled with self-doubt given the difficulties encountered by Edward O. Wilson? The trick may be, like Wilson, to spend less time devoted to our deficiencies and far more time attending to our strengths. Look around in your own life. What are the things that you truly cannot do about yourself and would be better off accepting? You might want to write out some self-deprecating thoughts and work to replace them with more constructive alternatives. Here are some examples. Try replacing "I've never been very smart" with "While I may have difficulties in some areas like math, I've got a remarkably good memory for details." The self-statement "I'm not very smart" is a global statement that doesn't fairly examine the breadth of your intelligence. It is a generalization that only does harm by encouraging self-pity and doubt. Here's another example. If you blame yourself by thinking, "My son's life is a mess," you may be implicitly thinking, "And it's my fault." Such thoughts can be changed to, "It's true that my son is having a difficult time. He has also had many bright spots in his life. I did the best I could under the circumstances, and now he has to make his own choice and live with the outcome." This more constructive interpretation would include the acceptance that your son has made his own choices, that many things are outside of your control, and that you are not responsible for your son's actions now. Focusing exclusively on the thought that your son's life is a mess is traveling on a road to frustration and sadness. Acceptance is quite a challenge, but if we put energy into meeting this challenge, the rewards are enormous. Remember, happiness takes work. Attend to it. I can be reached at robertpolicky.com. I would love to hear your comments and thoughts.
You've been listening to Dr. Robert Pollocky on Finding Happiness. Theme music by Kristen King.
You have everything. There will be those who have nothing to fear. And little by little, or maybe all at once, you will lose. Because our future is not yours to choose.
So welcome back to Voices of Reason and Resistance. Thank you so much for staying with us. We still have so much more to talk about. Food. First, I want to thank David Rovics for letting us use his wonderful song, There Will Always Be Resistance. Albert and I discovered that. Oh my God, I hate to even think how we're going back almost 9 years. And it's a wonderful song, and I actually have a friend in Chicago who occasionally listens, I hope he's listening today, who has been sending him information about where David Rovics is performing. And I said, put a bug in his ear. Tell him to come to Savannah. So thank you for coming back. Thank you for being with us on this 100th show. We've been talking about food. I hope it didn't make you hungry, or if it did, perhaps you will think about all of those people out there who are hungry, whose very existence is based upon their inability, their food insecurity, their housing insecurity, their health care insecurity, and what we can do as a country to deal with those insecurities. So where did we leave off? Remind me. What were we talking about?
So I kind of recall us just talking about the insecurity of our fellow Georgians, which
yes.
is to the tune of 1.4 million people will have their SNAP benefits impacted by the big beautiful bill.
Right, which isn't so beautiful. And that's a shameful thing to hear about.
It is.
And, yeah, again, in a country of such plenty, and yet we seem to be driven so much by profit and so little by our concerns for each other, for community, for, you know, I go back to, I had an experience a couple of years ago. I'm a member of Veterans for Peace, and they have a ship that sails called the Golden Rule. And they actually came up the Hudson River and down the Erie Canal, and I went to where they docked, and they talked. And they talked so much about the Golden Rule, do unto others how you would want others to do unto you. And how valuable that is. And do I want people to withhold my necessities of life because of my inability to pay? And no, I do not.
Well, I mean, I can speak as a person of faith.
Yes.
And not to evangelize your audience here.
No, please.
I mean, Scripture establishes a pretty clear mandate that
yes.
we should care for and feed the hungry and the poor. I mean, this
yes.
is a duty
yeah.
to God that is seen as an act of love for both God
right.
and for humanity.
Right.
I mean, there's key passages in the prophet Isaiah that instruct us to share food with hungry people and to provide for people in need. There are accounts in the Christian Gospels of Jesus feeding the multitudes. You know, this is really about taking care of your community. And I hear a rhetoric about, we shouldn't rely on government for such things. We should allow the churches and religious organizations to take care of folks. And while that might sound ideal to leave it to our communities, way too often, this comes with conditions. too frequently,
right,
religious organizations want to impose a particular belief structure,
yes,
on someone before that person receives assistance.
That's right.
You want them to listen to you preach for an hour before you give them food.
Right.
Or you want them to convert to your religion before you give them something to eat. That's not the way to do it. It's not my understanding of my own faith scripture as well. So I think all of us, regardless of our secular or faith traditions, can look back to what it is that motivates us from a spiritual or humanistic perspective,
right,
to care for and see my neighbor's face, or
right,
in the South African term, Ubuntu. You know, I see
okay.
you. I see God
right.
in you.
Right.
There's. I think without a real conversion, and
mm-hmm.
Not a conversion to any particular faith, but a
right.
conversion in terms of the way that we see our communities,
yes.
the way that we see our neighbors,
yep.
I don't understand how we're going to move forward.
I don't either.
And yes, that includes policy.
I agree. I agree completely. And yet in so many communities, including the one, sadly, that I live in right now, we so rarely see our neighbors. And even when I talk to people who live in Savannah in apartment complexes, they don't necessarily see their neighbors anymore. People are so rarely outside interacting with each other. It's almost, you know, we've lost our humanity because we don't even see our neighbors. We don't talk to them. We don't. They've become strangers to us.
I was going to kind of speak to that. Is what Harambe House is doing, is building community, building neighborhood, putting neighbors in a room together to work together, right? And it is Swahili for let's work.
Let's pull together.
Let's pull together.
Yes. Let's pull together.
Harambe, yes. And getting to the community gardens, that's another one of those good things about it, is because it really draws the community together. It when people see how you mentioned when you pass by your old garden and you see it flourishing,
yeah.
how it makes you feel.
Right.
Whenever we're doing stuff in the garden, it'd be me and maybe 3 or 4 young people. People are constantly stopping by. How can I help? How can I do this?
Wow.
How can I help? I want to do and. It's something about being just outside,
yep.
putting your hands in the dirt, that really draws, you know, it is a spiritual connection with that. It draws people together. And this is another way that we can use community gardens, community farms. We can use these as methods of developing our communities, you know, so it's not, so they don't take farm. If we're working the land, you can't take it and just build something on it. You have something to at least challenge that,
right?
It's an opportunity for us to because we're in I wouldn't say dire just yet, but we're in a pretty tough situation on all levels, socially, politically, economically, financially, on just a whole bunch of levels. And it's going to take, we have to challenge systems.
Yep.
And community garden is challenging the food system. And that's,
yes.
It can start there, but it covers so much because it covers health system, because a lot of people's motivation, one of my motivations is for health reasons.
Right.
Is you want to, you know, whenever you start, knock on wood, I'm not on any type of medication, and but I do feel I'm right at that place that if I don't do this or don't do that or don't do this, I'm one, you know, incident away from
yep.
being on something. But, you know, when you look at, when you go to look, okay, what can I do? What can I eat to help myself? Or what can
right.
I do? Time and time again, the thing that you see more than anything is green leafy vegetables.
Yes.
Green leafy vegetables. Green
yes.
leafy vegetables. Get more of that. And that's one of the easiest things to grow.
Right.
That is, they grow, because a lot of what people are calling weeds is really is some type of food.
That's right.
And it's a healthy food.
Mm-hmm.
And I have I'm sure some people can back this up, but I just have a theory that any weeds or just anything that grows real easy and real prolific, I think it's meant, that's something that we need. Yeah. It's meant to be like that. It's like the creator says, okay, I'm going to give you a lot of this because you need it.
Right.
You need it for something. You need this for something. And so, again, being in the gardens, being on the land, it inspires that type of thought from whether it's a younger person, an older person, whatever. It inspires, it causes a paradigm to shift, just being out there.
Right.
I think collard greens are my spiritual animal.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I can't resist them.
And again, one of the easiest things to grow.
Yeah.
Collard greens.
Collard greens and okra.
And okra,
My goodness.
You know, there's something, it goes back to story again, and the idea of community. When I think we learn so much about one another through the foods that we share.
Right.
And bringing community together through a supper club or through a potluck, maybe it's time to reignite those kinds of, you know, those kinds of activities within our own neighborhoods. Have a block party. Everybody bring something.
Yes.
About every 6 weeks, my church has a potluck Eucharist where our church service is literally lunch. Everybody sits around a big table, we take the bread and the wine from the table, and that becomes our Eucharist in our tradition, because that's how the early church rolled. That's what they did. They sat around people's houses, fed one another, and listened to stories and extracted meaning from those stories.
Right.
There's something that happens when we share our food with one another.
Yep.
When I was a student, when I made gumbo or red beans and rice or jambalaya for my friends in California, and they were like, dude, who are you? Where is this coming from?
Yes.
But then they would take me to their favorite taqueria, and I got to see what a real taco tastes like. Or, you know, my friends from different cultures than I came from also share those experiences. Food fosters a deeper understanding of one another.
It does.
And when we understand where our food comes from and the importance of food to our culture, that speaks volumes about who we can be as community.
Yes.
Not sure.
Well, I will speak to that. This fall, we have an event coming up November the 15th called Dairy Days. It will be at the Old Roberts Garden at the end of Tennessee Avenue, 2500 Tennessee Avenue. And we are bringing together community for food and camaraderie and art and music. And it's all to benefit I As We, which is a local nonprofit which specializes in feeding young people in challenged neighborhoods, especially in between East Broad and Abercorn, and from Henry to Gwinnett, right? Amon Truitt, he has been out there doing the work. And again, it's a hard time for nonprofits. We all know how difficult it is to raise funds, but he has been doing it on a very shoestring budget. And we'd like to bring the community together to celebrate him, but also other nonprofits, and hopefully raise a little money and put some money in their coffers for the work that they're doing in feeding young people and showing up year round. So that'll be November 15th, and it's Dairy Days, and the 912 group are the sponsors.
Thank you for mentioning that. Mm-hmm. That's very important. The other thing I'm wondering is, I know when I came to Savannah and I moved in with Albert at the Tribe House, we were very involved with Food Not Bombs, and I'm told that there is two offerings by Food Not Bombs at Wells Park on Wednesdays and Sundays. Are there others? I've been trying to get in touch with the people who do the Food Not Bombs and haven't had the opportunity to connect with them yet.
They're still operational. They used to prep their meals at my former church.
Oh, yeah, okay.
We had a commercial kitchen. A great organization that, you know, it's real simple. Food, not bombs. And it goes back to the Vietnam era where instead of dropping bombs on folks, maybe we should drop food on them.
That's right.
I think maybe it's time for more dropping of food.
Wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that be amazing? And there were times when care packages would be dropped from planes, but it seems like there's more bombs these days.
I mean, there are a number of soup kitchens in around downtown Savannah, at least, and they predominantly serve our neighbors who are experiencing homelessness, but anybody can go. I work with Emmaus House on occasion. Our church founded a clothing closet that operates out of there.
Okay.
It's a wonderful example of a local organization that's interfaith, that's that doesn't proselytize or evangelize,
right?
Through outward means, at least. It's about feeding people, period.
Right.
And man, I've had plenty of meals there, and I don't know how the chefs accomplish what they do.
Right.
But there's some terrific organizations.
And is this through Feeding America? So if you go to
No, this is different.
This is completely
you can get a home cooked meal at Emmaus House every morning. It's breakfast, but sometimes it's often it can be, you know, baked chicken or macaroni and cheese or something that's and then, you know, there are a number of other places around Savannah.
And is there any directory or place that people can go to find out where these places are?
Is that a project we could... Well, no, there's a list on the Savannah Chatham Homeless Authority webpage. That does. And there have been some local students who have attempted to make kind of maps that you can hand out.
And
I'll say if you're going to do the legwork, you can get around Savannah. You can eat three squares a day between Emmaus House and... Union Mission or Salvation Army or Old Savannah City Mission, some of the other places. So there are places to eat, but those are temporary. I mean, that's a meal, you know.
Right.
With families, people who need to sustain feeding an entire family, we need better and bigger long-term solutions.
Absolutely.
And that's going to involve challenging and changing those systems that you named.
Right.
It's how we change our thought. It's how we change policy. Yep. It's how we change our own patterns of behavior, both at a local and at a federal level.
Agree. When we make the decision that we have the right to these things, and everybody has the right to these things, and that's how the policy decisions get made. I agree. And, you know, I have housing, food, and health care as my top three.
Sure.
And there may be other things we want to put on that list. But to me, those are the top priorities. Yeah.
I think they are for most Americans.
Yes.
So it does, you know, we can pause to consider when you're in a position where you only have to spend, you know, around 8% of your income on eating. That frees up
a
lot for, you know, where's the sharing here?
Right. Where's the sharing?
There's a wonderful interpretation about the feeding of the multitudes in the Christian Gospels. Where, you know, you've got 5,000 people out hanging out, and they're hearing a great word about, you know, systemic change, is what Jesus was talking about.
Yeah.
And there is a, they realize folks here are hungry. What are we going to feed them?
Right.
You know, most folks probably have heard the story. There are five loaves and a couple of fishes. How are we going to feed this multitude with so little food?
Right.
One of the interpretations, if you don't want to go supernatural miracle direction with it, is the idea that if you can get a couple of people to part with five loaves of bread and a couple of fishes, their neighbor is going to look around and say, you know what, I got a fish in my back pocket, I'll throw it in as well. Somebody else says, well, I got a loaf of bread in my bag, I'll contribute that. And before you know it, things start coming out.
That's right.
And you have the proverbial stone soup, where the neighborhood is contributing to one another.
Right, I was just thinking of
we have that stoop. Capacity.
We do have that
human
capacity.
Human beings and communities, we do.
Right. And we become more human when we do that. And we connect with people in special ways. And that's one of the things I do love about community gardens and the other opportunities for people to come together over food. It is an amazing opportunity. And it does increase our humanity and brings us together with people. And one of the things I will mention, since we've been talking about it, is a place that I have been getting together with for the past a little bit more than a year, and it's called Your Space Collective. And Your Space was right off Victory Drive, a lovely, beautiful old house, and I used to love to go over there. And it was very connected to that community. There would be people who would be dropping by all the time and lots of coming and going. They have a mutual aid closet. And unfortunately, profit seems to drive too many people. And the person who owned the house decided, oh, I can get $1 million for this house. So they uprooted, and now they're at 2022 West Bay Street. Which, it's a little bit different, and it needs quite a bit of work. And as I know from my dealings with Yamacraw, it's in an area that very much is being targeted right now by people with money to make more money. And if you've been to the going the other way on Bay Street, going east. I haven't been in Savannah that long, only 10 years, but I've seen incredible changes there. The changes to, I don't know exactly all that was there before, but I do know what's there now. And I see people with dollar signs in their eyes thinking, we can do that on the west side too.
So yeah, we are the hardest thing when it comes to the land market. And so people from all over the globe now have realized what a beautiful, nice community this is. There is that. I would also like to point out that the DSA has a mutual aid on Saturdays from 1 to 3 at the corner of 37th and Waters. And you can come up and get clothing and food as needed. Just show up.
So when is that Saturday 1 to 3?
It's 1 to 3 every Saturday.
Okay. That's good to know. And there is another group that I learned about. And this is a group that the second Saturday of every month, the Really Free Market. And they were getting together in Daffin Park at Water in Washington. And then they kind of moved to a space off of Skidaway, off of President Street, off of Skidaway. I'm not sure. I think it's Skidaway. Skidaway and maybe 38th or something like that. But a lot of that had to do with weather, with the incredible rains we've been having. But that is actually a wonderful place. They just, you can bring something, you can give something. And my granddaughter practically raised her. She's now 10. And I took carloads of her baby things, and I cried when I left them behind. But as I was getting in my car, I saw some little kids wandering over to the blanket and playing with her things, and I thought, this is what life is supposed to be about. You know, you use what you need when you need it, and then you pass it on.
Yes.
And that was just such a beautiful thing to do.
And this is the thing. This goes back to the idea of scarcity and abundance, right?
Yes.
And so we live in a time and space and age of such abundance, right?
Such abundance.
High-quality goods, right, that you can use and then pass along to be shared. Whereas at other points in history, things were not as well made and didn't last as long. And so there is not a need to go out and buy brand new everything, but we have been conditioned to be consumers and to attach our self-worth and validation to whether or not we can go buy a high-priced good out of a store when we have all of these wonderful thrift stores and Goodwills and Salvation Armies that provide the same goods at a fraction of the price.
And there are communities around the country that are opening up like little repair places. Albert and I had this incredible toaster. The two sides opened, and it was just a very incredible thing, but it wasn't working. I drove around with that in my car, stopping and stopping. Does anybody fix toasters? And most people laughed at me. You can get refurbished appliances, and that's a good thing, but little pieces of machinery, not so much. And that is really sad. And the other thing, I wanted to go back to the whole issue of community gardens and small farms. There are many countries around the world, and I had an incredible opportunity back in 2019 to visit Cuba with a group called the Venceremos Brigade. And one of the things that Fidel Castro, who is truly one of my heroes, did was land reform. And he's not the only one. There are other countries that went through land reform. And you basically gave people 3, 4, 5 acres of land if they would make it productive. And it was a way to share the wealth. It was a way to get people working. It was and for Cuba in particular, having lived with a blockade since 1960, such a hard time getting what the people need. It was just an incredible thing to do. And the other thing, of course, when I was in Cuba, I'm not going to hold my breath that it would actually happen here, is that because they're of the blockade, people actually plow the land the old-fashioned way with plows that they push. And I have read about that being so much better for the land. It doesn't compress it down, and it makes it much more productive. And land reform is something that, well, we talked about it. That it was talked about in this country as the Civil War was winding down. The enslaved people were supposed to get 20 acres. And there were actually people here in 40 acres, that's right, I'm sorry. And there were actually people who started moving out to Wormslow Plantation to scope out their 40 acres. And, you know, it wasn't there, there wasn't a commitment to it. There was not a commitment to it for many reasons, as we, yes, yes. That was very, very sad. And we, but we still can do it. There is land. There is a way to break up these big, huge parcels and do our own form of land reform. Reparations to the people we bought and sold here. Reparations to the people whose land we stole. That could be an incredible thing.
And I'm glad you mentioned the low-till, no-till. And that is a method that we are using.
Okay.
Where we may break the soil once with a tiller. I mean, once or twice. But we're moving towards no-tilling because of all of the things that you were talking about.
Yeah.
And that's a part of the regenerative farming. Well, one of the terms that we use, regenerative farming.
Regenerative farming. And, I like that.
But that's because of the you don't disturb the biology in the soil,
right?
When you is keep tilling it, it's like you destroy. You know, it's like that's real. That's like traumatic to the soil and the biology in the soil, and it's been a lot of work done in those fields, and it's so much healthier for the soil, and that brings that's the taste that comes back. That biology. You don't have to. You don't have to use the fertilizers as much. You don't have to use.
Right.
You can. It's almost like a natural fertilizer because the biology creates its own minerals and nutrients for the soil. Because we really a farmer, you growing the soil, you working the soil, and it's growing the vegetables for you.
Right, that's
you
right.
Getting the soil right. You growing.
Yes.
You working soil. You're not. Yes. And this, you get the soil right. Mother Nature going to do everything else for you.
Yep.
I remember about 20 years ago, I was making a documentary in Peru, and it was in over the Andes in a coffee-producing region. And one of the farmers was telling me a story about when the organic co-ops had moved in and were trying to help them make a conversion from industrial factory farming into more organic, sustainable practices. They explained the process about taking things like goat urine and putting it as a pest deterrent and creating a system of crops that would fertilize one another.
Right.
And something dawned in this farmer telling me the story. He went, oh, you mean go back to the way my grandfather used to do it?
Yes.
Yeah, that worked really well.
Yes.
That was, I remember that. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
We're down. There are thousands of years of history that we can't preclude from the decision making that we're engaged with today. I mean, what's best for the land? What's best for the people?
Right.
These are important questions.
Mm-hmm. Incredibly important questions. And it's not what's best for the investors, for the people who see dollars in front of their eyes and nothing else.
Real quick, the reason that one of the reasons that the what they call in modern agriculture now uses so much heavy pesticides, one of it's nitrogen. It's a nitrogen. It's not nitrogen oxide, but it's a nitrogen compound. But the reason it, after World War II, they had a large supply of this, and because what they would use that for is to put on the ground to make it hard, so that when you land the planes, that it was hard enough for the planes to land.
Okay.
And they had a big surplus of this afterwards, and with that big surplus, they realize it's like an ammonia. It's a type of ammonia. The nitrogen makes the if you give something nitrogen, it makes the grass grow fast and looks real pretty and green.
Right.
It makes it looks real pretty and green. And so they start promoting that to farmers. But what it does is that it grows too fast, and they grow so fast that they can't build up their own pesticides itself. So the pests come. It make it real easy for the pests. So you got to make extra. You got to put extra pesticides on it to stop that. So that's that, and that's prior to maybe World War One. It was what would be considered organic and sustainable practices. That's kind of what they were that we were doing.
Ammonium nitrate.
Yeah, ammonium nitrate.
Ammonium nitrate. Yeah.
Yep, that's it. And it makes the and so over years of using it, it makes because they was using it to make the ground hard. So after they use it, you know, after years, 10, 20 years of using it, the ground is hard as a rock.
It wouldn't be the first industry to sustain a problem for profit.
Right. Absolutely.
We can create
not.
A solution, we can generate more profit.
Right. So when did they start with the nitrogen? After World War
One? Yeah, I think after World War One. It's either World War II.
Okay. World War II, okay.
And that's when they started promoting the fertilizer. What's so crazy is that the big farms, the smaller farms, because fertilizers, those fertilizers was a major part. You kind of need a lot of money to buy.
Yes,
it,
expensive.
Because it was very expensive. So the smaller farmers couldn't afford the fertilizer, so they stuck to the older ways. So those older ways that they stuck to, though, that was the what would be called organic now.
Right.
So
right.
And it's so funny because they're moving away from that, but now it's whole movements to. Because it's ways that they have to fix it now, because some of the most fertile land in America was destroyed over that. And so they had the regenerative farming movement and the biodynamic, that's a movement that's come about to help correct some of the larger farms that have been destroyed because of the history of pesticides and fertilizers
and using the ammonium nitrate
and using ammonium,
and so it becomes a cyclical problem and solution, right?
Yes. So, but that's and internationally, we have to be. This is something that we need to be careful of because the United States and Europe was kind of ahead of the curve on this. But some of the practices that we're going away from, the harmful practices that we're going away from in the United States, they're exporting it over to Africa. Because in Africa, a lot of their ground it hasn't been tampered like that.
Right.
But they're promoting the stuff that's illegal here. They're promoting the GMO seeds and stuff to some of those poor nations.
Well, that's what happened to Zimbabwe, actually. So Zimbabwe, they introduced GMO corn there, and then the European Union then refused any exports from Zimbabwe. Whereas before the 1980s, Zimbabwe was literally one of the breadbaskets of Africa.
Wow.
So it's. You know, that's to show the craziness and the quote unquote evil of industrial agriculture, but also it shows how we're connected. We're connected.
Right.
The same movements and how food is a social thing and all that. That's a worldwide concept. And these issues that we're having are food. When they talk about food insecurity in Africa, I'm like, what? Food insecurity? But they're in their communities, they're talking about it's hard for them to get fresh foods in some of the larger metropolitan cities, the Accras and all this. I'm looking at stuff that's saying this, they're having issues getting fresh organic food. I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
Well, we've seen a move, obviously, from industrialized farming to other parts of the world. And we go back to, can I say Monsanto on the air? Remember their Terminator seed technology that they were researching?
Yep.
A seed that would not reproduce itself.
Right.
Which left the farmer dependent on a particular type of technology.
Yes.
It's incredibly exploitative.
Incredibly exploitative because you had to keep buying seeds as opposed to being able to reuse your seeds.
And it's made its way into some of those countries.
Yes.
And the people are, you have, again, just like here, you have a community that's saying, you have some politicians and some people that's saying, this is necessary. It is, we're behind. This is, and then you have another saying, like, no, these some of the things that you're bringing in. It's movements going on in these countries to outlaw it. And matter of fact, in some of these countries, it's outlawed. So don't let them bring that to us.
Right.
You know, it's promoted as new technology.
Yep.
Well, even the way the FDA approves food additives, right? So they have a policy known as GRAS, right? Generally recognized as safe.
Yes.
And so food companies can use new chemicals and additives without FDA oversight, right? The GRSA was first implemented in the 1950s, and really little has changed since those requirements were put in place. So as long as the substance is generally recognized among qualified experts, having been adequately shown to be safe, new ingredients are fair game. And so you have these corporate scientists, corporate ecologists, who then justify and really introduce these new additives, and they're seen as experts in their field with no oversight, right? So ingredients like the trans fats that were permitted before the GRAS are grandfathered in, despite it being linked to 500,000 deaths a year due to heart disease.
Yep. And then we have all those other ingredients that are banned in most countries, but we're still allowed here by those same experts, of course. Mm-hmm. Bleached flour, dough conditioners, BHA, BHT, food dyes. We hear about them, and we still sell most of them here. And companies make two sets of products. So you often wonder, isn't that more expensive?
Well, think about it. You have the Coke that we all have been consuming, and then the Mexican Coke, which is just cane sugar. Is natural, right?
Yes. You haven't lived till you've had a Mexican Coke. And, of course, you can buy them here, but they're incredibly expensive. They sit like a special little place on the shelves. And, you know, the other thing, since we mentioned Mexico, I'll say that Mexico has been very adamant to the USA, keep your GMOs away from us. We do not want them. We do not want your GMO corn. They grow heirloom corn in Mexico, and they do not want it to be destroyed by this GMO corn.
And Canada did the same thing with their wheat.
Okay. So countries know it. And it's time that we caught up with everybody else. It's ridiculous. It's insane.
Well, it's interesting. There's some discussion recently about, from this current federal administration, about Mexican Coke because it doesn't contain high fructose corn syrup. And there's a little bit of traction about it, you know, producing it that way in the United States. But dietitians are now speaking up, and they're saying, can we hang on a second? Do we really want to... I mean, regardless of whether it's made of corn syrup or sugar, do we really want to increase our intake of sugar and fructose corn syrup and caloric intake? Because this is going to be a problem if we're going to market and popularize this.
Right.
I grew up in the town where Coca-Cola was first put in a bottle in whatever year that was, 1890 or whatever, like that. And the bottles were tiny.
Mm. Yes.
You know, we remember a serving of Coke was 8 ounces.
Yep.
And that's a cup. A cup of Coke, right?
A cup of Coke.
Think about how many ounces of Coke are in a regular ginormo super gulp, whatever
liters.
It is. Right? You know, I can go through a 2 liter in a day if I'm not careful.
Right.
This goes back to something you brought up earlier, which is about what we're putting in our bodies, why we're putting it in our bodies. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with an 8 ounce of Coke. I'm with you. You know, Mexican Coke is delicious.
It's absolutely delicious.
You know? But it goes back to, I think, our value system and change. What is important? You know, green leafy vegetables are great. How do I get my kids to eat that? Through lots of testing and lots of trying some things out until I found something that they said, hey, you know what, Dad? Do this over again. I'll eat this again.
That tastes good. Yeah, that tastes good. I know I'm doing the same thing with my granddaughter. I mean, she'd much rather sit down and eat a whole bag of chips. So I'm trying to find things that, I mean, she was with us last weekend, and she loves corn. I said, okay, then we'll start with that. We'll move to other kinds of things.
Another one of those great things of community gardens is when you get the young people, when you get them in there early, they're just they're just grabbing it and they're just trying it.
Yes.
Because they feel like they created it. Yeah. So they're like, it's way easier if they grew an eggplant and then tried to cook something with it, as opposed to you show them this purple thing they never seen before. And they're like, you know, and they bite into it. It don't take, you know, this. Mm. So, but it does, especially the little ones. When they are, they'll just grab something and just, when they, can we eat this? Yeah. and they'll try
That's
it.
That's right.
And it really it changes their. I'm sure some study that was done that shows the younger a person starts eating fresh, right. that they appreciate that they would prefer that to other things.
Yeah. And I'm sure, you know, our taste buds have been so changed by the kind of food that we've mm-hmm. grown used to.
And that's a really great point. That's part and parcel with food deserts,
yes.
with the way that our bodies get conditioned.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a period in my life where it was high salt and high fat and a lot of sugar,
right.
and that's what my body craved.
Yep.
You know, mm-hmm. and it was like quitting smoking, getting off of junk food.
Yes.
I'm proud of myself. I'm healthier for it. I'm still around. That's terrific.
Right.
There's part of me that still craves a Big Mac every now and then,
mm-hmm.
like an ex-junkie, you know?
Yes. Yes.
But, and I'm sure somebody can make an argument. I'm sure it's probably fine to have one every now and then. But I find it much more rewarding to go, go to my friend's place and have a hamburger there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So can I ask you while I have you two here, how do we mitigate, dare I say, eliminate food insecurity in our
yeah.
community? What kind of ideas do you have about this, and how can we work together as a community to bring these ideas to fruition?
You can start by just growing something yourself. You can grow, all you need is a little bit of space, and you can grow anything with that. You start there, and then, you know, the community, from that to a bigger space, to a community garden, to supporting community farms. But the whole idea, again, and that's part of the challenge, is that we have the capacity to a degree to do that. So now is the time we need to take advantage of the momentum and the energy around community gardens and grow, because it's a lot right now, like across the world, but it's
right.
a lot of them. So we need to take advantage of that momentum, and then the people who are already doing it, we got to take it to the next level of systems and standards of operation, and you know, and that's why we want to partner with the farmers. Learn from the farmers. Learn from the people who do this. Some of the things that they put in place to make themselves more productive, and we can take it to that level. It's this idea within small farms that you can make $100,000 off an acre. And not using pesticides and fertilizers.
Right.
So, you know, some of it is marketing, but at the same time, it's some truth to it. And what I really like about that is that it shows that off of just a little bit, you can feed a lot of people off if you put those systems in place like you're supposed to. But they have some really, I wouldn't say sophisticated, but some pretty good systems of when they plant things, how they clean it, how they package it, how to distribute it, where to put the tools, what tools to have, you know, what, you
right.
know, they
right.
They have a real calendar, a real strict calendar that they follow. But you start talking with and partnering and learning from, because a farmer plans and thinks like a career farmer. They have to plan and think like that.
Yeah.
So if we can partner with farmers, with community garden, the people who are thinking like that, and really come up with some and then partner with the churches, partner with the food pantries, partner with the, we all got to partner together. That is a challenge. We have to partner together to figure out, one, on how to mitigate this, and then also show it is an industry. It's an industry that can be profitable, and you do not have to use the same model of exploitation that corporations use, and you can still be profitable with this.
Right. What do you think about creating classes in the schools where kids can actually learn farming and be taken to farms as a profession, like you had shop? And
I think they have to do that. It's just like Future Farmers of America.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes that's something that they usually just talk about in like rural areas. But
right.
it has to just how shop needs to come back.
Yep.
That needs to be it needs to be almost mandatory.
Yeah.
And FFA's got great jackets. those blue corduroy coats.
Yeah, yeah, right.
You know what I'm talking about?
They do.
I agree. There has to be some kind of systemic change, and that's going to include education. It's going to include a cultural shift, and any kind of cultural shift can be really difficult for us.
Yes.
You know, there was food I ate as a kid that it was what my friends ate. You know, I ate Vienna sausage sandwiches with mayonnaise on Wonder Bread, right? I'm not putting that in my body anymore.
Right.
But there's a part of my brain somewhere that still kind of craves that.
Oh, yeah.
So we need a cultural shift. We need an educational shift about what we eat, why we eat it, and where it comes from. I'm a huge fan of what you're doing at Harambe House.
Thank you.
I'm loving what you're sharing with us today. In the meantime, before we can get to that, we got to feed people.
That's right.
And it's an unfortunate truth that we need food pantries today.
Right.
So if folks are listening and they want to help, please contribute to your local food pantry. You can get a list of those food pantries at feedingamerica.com or .org, I forgot, which will take you can search food pantries by zip code. If you'd like to donate to our food pantry, the I Am Food Pantry at the Episcopal Church of the Epiphany, you can drop food off to us. I just got a text message that we distributed 52 distributed groceries to 52 families.
Wow.
That's... Yeah, 52 families.
That's 52 families that will eat.
That are going to eat this week. And
right.
those fresh vegetables from the Forsyth Farmers Market went a long way.
That's
And
great.
It was exciting talking about how to prepare eggplant with people today.
Right.
I felt like I was doing my research last night with that ratatouille.
Yeah. No, that sounds wonderful. And share the recipe with us, maybe, and we can get it out there.
You talked about how to get kids into eating vegetables. I got my kids into eating eggplant from that movie Ratatouille. Because we wanted to make the ratatouille that he makes at the end, and we made the little tiny circles, and we cooked it all separately and stacked it all up. And I didn't go through all that trouble last night, but it was really delicious. You know, it was just vegetables. And I got to tell you, I got three teenage boys, and there's one of their girlfriends, and they just cleaned us out last night. I mean, I thought sure we were going to have leftovers. No luck.
You need to do that again and film it.
Okay.
Get it out there.
Well, it is gumbo tonight. I got okra at the farmer's market this weekend, and that's one of my... I think okra is proof that there's a God and God loves us.
Because it's so abundant.
It is delicious. And I know it's not everybody's jam, but it should be.
Yeah. And I need to learn. I need to have some. You know, I came down here with my northern taste buds. So it was hard for me to deal with. And I never did take taste for sweet tea. Forget it.
Well, I suffer from dietary indiscretion, and that has got me into trouble on more than one occasion. Maybe we shouldn't talk about that, but I'll eat anything twice. Who knows? I mean, maybe the first time it wasn't prepared right.
Right,
so.
Right. Yeah, okra has a special way of being prepared, and I will say that my southern friends did try.
Have you had fried okra?
Hmm?
Have you had fried okra?
I'm not sure. Okay. Do you bread it and fry it?
Oh, yeah. Okay, we can give you a list after the show of places to go and get some fried okra.
Okay.
I had some, where did I have that fried okra recently? It was someplace locally. And I thought, man, that was fantastic.
Yeah.
It lit me up.
Cool. I don't necessarily want to get taste buds for sweet tea. I eat enough sweet stuff.
Fair enough.
But okra, I would definitely like to know how to do better. And eggplant and other products grown locally, healthy, and you know, put a thumb in the eye of the corporate ag.
Well, if your listeners can donate a can or two of non-perishables, you can bring them by any food pantry, and I'm going to plug the I Am Food Pantry at the at Daffin Park in the corner of Washington and Waters, and we've got some boxes at both entrances. You can drop some things off, and we will make sure they get distributed. We even have a little pantry out front. So if you miss the food pantry deliveries on Tuesdays, we keep that little, it's like a little library.
Oh,
we keep it stocked with cans.
That's incredible. Yeah. So one of the things we didn't discuss, and maybe we're running out of time and it's too late to talk about it, is this whole issue of sell-by dates. And at one point, I remember when we were doing Food Not Bombs, the grocery stores did have permission to give things past their sell-by dates away without any repercussions, without somebody coming back and suing you. And is that still the case? Do we know? Because I have read some, I don't know. it's been a while since I've been involved. But, you know, if we maybe that's something we look into and, you know, bring up the next time. Because I remember with Food Not Bombs, they could go in there. I think they had a little piece of paper, and they said, this is what we're going to do with it. And they would come away with lots of food.
There's a great, it's really a really fun documentary film from 2010 called Dive. And the filmmaker and his friends introduce us to their good-spirited dumpster diving.
Okay.
And they go dumpster diving at grocery stores the day that these foods are disposed of. And it's remarkable. It's wildly entertaining.
Yes.
To watch these kids jumping dumpsters and get food. I'm not suggesting to your listeners to go do this.
Right.
But it is a really great, fun watch.
That sounds good. And I know Lewis, he didn't dumpster dive for food, but I remember one day leaving his show on Wednesday evening, and he stops by a dumpster by a florist, and he was creating all these amazing bouquets with what was in the dumpsters, and it was lovely. So, where are we here? Are we close? Four minutes.
We are close, and what I was doing here was kind of checking out the different food pantries and feeding programs here. And we have quite a few locally.
Okay. Good. So at some point it would be wonderful. And I mean, one of my frustrations has been that there's not, and maybe there is, and I'm just not aware of it, like a United Way or something like that, where they have all this information in one place
so
that they can share.
I am at the helpinhunger.org or the Second Harvest site. So this is Second Harvest of Coastal Georgia. So you can go straight to their site. And not only does it come up, each address, each point on the map, so you know exactly where you can go.
Yes.
So it is very interactive, very reactive.
Good.
So, yes, this is the Second Harvest of Coastal Georgia website.
Great. Thank you.
And that's their parent organization, feedingamerica.org, also will give you a directory to Second Harvest as well as that interactive map that Apollo's brought up.
Great.
It really is. It's a terrific map. It tells you all the places around the community that have food pantries and when they're operational.
Okay.
This is the times, the spaces. The coordinators who you can contact, the phone numbers. So yes, it's again very interactive and very informative.
That is wonderful. So I will use our last 2 minutes to thank our wonderful, incredible guests. I'll let you all say one last thing, and to thank our listeners who were with us today. And next week we're going to talk about labor, the right to a living wage. Do we have the right to a living wage, or is it just one more commodity that the corporations are taking advantage of? And it'll be the day after what some of you call Labor Day. To me, March 1st is Labor Day. May Day is always Labor Day in my heart. So, would you like to say goodbye? And
I would like to thank WRUU for having me. It's been a pleasure to talk. I think community radio is still the thing. You know, I know that with all of the YouTubes and TikToks and all, and not to discredit those, but this is the original YouTubes and TikToks. This is the original People's Radio.
This
so
is it.
Please support it.
Thank you.
You know, thank you to all the listeners out there. And Community Garden, the most important thing, Community Gardens and Community Farms, is the community part because it's a community effort.
Okay, 40 seconds.
Oh, I want to give a big thanks.
Thank you. Say thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Who are you giving big thanks to?
To all y'all.
Oh, thank you.
For having me. Mike. This has been a great conversation.
It's wonderful. I'm so glad you were here. It wouldn't have been the same without you.
Well, I'll just say thank the community. I appreciate the listeners and the support that we're garnering. Looking forward to discussing labor next week. Thank you all.
Oh, thank you all. I'm sorry.
I'm talking about a great looking hat.
It went too long.
Well, I'm not quite sure what that is, but it's an automation, so it's